You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston, tuku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, the 1st of December. My name is Jemima and I'm your host today, and I'm joined in studio by producers Hannah and Noah. How are you both going?
Good.
We had a little bit of an interesting start to The Wire, which is why you heard a song after the news. But it's fine. It's all good. It's nice to have all of us here, which is lovely. We have some cool stuff coming up on the show today. So Noah is looking into the government announcement yesterday that paid sick leave will increase from 5 days to 10 by the end of 2021. He speaks to Retail New Zealand and Etu for their perspectives on the change. I report on the news that WorkSafe is charging 13 parties in relation to the Whakaari White Island disaster in December last year. I speak to Professor of Volcanology Shane Cronin about what the proceedings might do for future changes to volcano hazard management. Hannah speaks to Tony Boyton, who is from the Te Rōpū Tautoko Māori, about their petition to support in support of Māori wards. Noah also talks to the Electoral Commission about youth voter turnout this election. And finally, I talk to Francesca Goodman-Smith, who is the industry representative of the Otago University Food Waste Research Team, about her study into food waste in New Zealand and the cost-saving motivators behind reducing food waste. He aho o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so tuku pātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395 or Waia Mai Rānei, you can give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, koe e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō he pakihiri rokiroki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Poho. Me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95bfm.com/bcasts. We're under the wire. Everything we do is always there, so if you missed it, check it out. If you're looking for something newsy to listen to on your drive, or on your walk somewhere, have a listen, because The Wire's always coming up with some really cool pieces. But as we're a little bit late into the show today, we will crack right in.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire. Yesterday, the government introduced a bill to expand sick leave entitlements from 5 days to 10 days a year. Workplace Relations and Safety Minister Michael Wood says the bill will go through the full select committee process and is expected to pass in mid-2021. However, there have been some critics. I spoke to Chief Executive of Retail New Zealand, Greg Harford, who has come out against the plan.
The big issue with the proposal is the unintended consequence around part-time workers. Under the bill, as we understand it's going to be, every employee who's eligible for sick leave will get up to 10 days a year. That includes part-time workers and those that only work 1 day a week. There's about 20% of retail workers who do only work 1 day a week. And this proposal means that almost one-fifth of their working year will be available for sick leave. The outcome of it is simply that employers will be incentivised not to offer part-time roles, and that will have a big impact on students who are looking for part-time work or perhaps parents who are looking for part-time work to fit around family responsibilities.
Could you go a little bit into why that would disincentivise businesses from offering part-time work?
Yeah. For employees who work 1 day a week, a 10-day sick leave entitlement is equivalent to 20% of their working year. If you're employing a full-time worker, it's a much smaller proportion. So in terms of maintaining equity, we think it's sensible to prorate those sick leave entitlements, just like annual leave is prorated, so that if you work part-time, you still get sick leave, but you get a smaller entitlement.
So on the alternative side, Labour has argued businesses are also hurt if sick people come in and spread bugs to their colleagues. How would you respond to that?
we're not objecting to the extension of sick leave to 10 days a year. What we are objecting to is that being a uniform requirement across the whole workforce, where it needs to be prorated for part-time workers.
And so I saw in your press release it said you'll be making a submission on the bill. What will you be saying to the government?
Our submission on the bill will be arguing the case for prorating of sick leave entitlements for part-time employees. That's the best way of making sure that those part-time jobs are still available for students or parents with family responsibilities who want to work part-time.
Michael Wood has said a lot of businesses already give their workers 10 days. Why is it an issue to legislate it?
It's certainly true that many businesses do offer their employees more than 5 days sick leave every year, but they're typically not applying more than 5 days sick leave to people who work part-time, perhaps only one day a week. We're simply saying that if the sick leave entitlement is to be extended, it should be prorated for part-time employees, just like annual leavers, and indeed just like sick leave in Australia is.
That was Greg Harford from Retail NZ on the government's plan to increase sick leave entitlements. I also spoke to Annie Newman, Assistant National Secretary of the Union Air 2, which represents over 50,000 workers from various sectors. I started by asking her what Air 2 thought of the proposed bill.
Yes, we're delighted that the government's moving on it. They made that promise before the election. It will make a massive difference to particularly the private sector workers, large numbers of whom are on 5 days minimum statutory sick leave. So this is a real step change because the current environment is incredibly unfair for workers. Most viruses take longer than 5 days. We've had that brutal experience of COVID-19 where we know that that's the case. But viruses in general take more than 5 days for people to recover from. And so they don't have the leave so that they can continue to be paid. Now, when you're on low wages, that's very damaging. It's hard to survive, it's hard to pay your rent and keep food on the table if, in fact, you're taking time off on no pay.
So there have been some critics of the plan, such as the National Party. Their workplace relations spokesperson, Scott Simpson, said the plan puts pressure on businesses and can even discourage them from taking on new staff. How would you respond to that?
I think that it's a mean and short-sighted view about the reality for working people. So when somebody goes to work sick because they have no choice, they put their workmates at sick at risk because they become sick. If they go to work and they're sick and they're in the service industry, they are putting all the people who use those services at risk. And so they are therefore putting the communities at risk. Now, what we know is that ultimately that puts the economy at risk. And we only need to look at what's happened in COVID-19 to see that any form of outbreak of COVID-19 has a devastating impact on the economy. And we can't afford to do that. So the government is quite right that at this stage, when it has become so obvious to us that sick leave is important if we're going to manage the well-being of the entire nation and therefore the economy, then we have to increase that statutory minimum. That's not just something that should happen now. That's something that should continue. A lot of people are saying that this is one virus. There are many at the door waiting to get in. So we know that this is the reality of living in a highly populated world with many potential viruses around. So we've got to be smart about this if we want to protect our economy for the future. And businesses have to play their part in that. This is not just about workers bearing the brunt of a national crisis. It's about all of us coming in together. I think one of the things that we have to remember is that the government actually said wanted to go hard and go early to manage this virus. Now, the opposition largely did not agree with that strategy, and yet that strategy has been proven internationally to be the right strategy.
There have been the CEO of Retail New Zealand is another critic of the proposed plan, and he said that part-time employees who are only working a small amount shouldn't get the full 10 days, and instead sick leave should be prorated. How would you respond to that?
I think it misunderstands why we have sick leave. We have sick leave because we get sick. And if you would otherwise be working, then you need sick leave, or otherwise you're losing the income that you depend upon. So to say that it should be prorated and therefore you may not be able to have sick leave when you're sick is defeating the point of having it in the beginning. I think the other thing is that many workers do not choose to work part-time. They want more hours of work. And so they shouldn't be punished because they need more hours of work in order to survive. So I think that we have to recognise that part-time work is a very big part of the workforce now. And those workers need to be protected just like everybody else. You know, we need to take an approach to working life and to these things as being a bit of a public good, that actually we need to think beyond our own business and think about the collective of New Zealand and the workers as a whole in New Zealand, the businesses as a whole, the economy as a whole. And in order to do that, we all have to play our part. For businesses, they need to start factoring in the care that's required in order to sustain a really productive workforce. And that means a healthy workforce.
Assuming the bill is passed into law next year, what effects do you expect to see?
Well, I think that people will be able to take leave. I think we have to also remember that parents who have to take sick leave when their children are sick. So what you get is this massive disadvantage for people who are working parents, and most parents are working. And they can't take sick leave for themselves because they're taking it for their children. So one of the things I think we'll see is a whole lot of pressure come off a low-paid essential workforce, because now we know that they are an essential workforce, that pressure will come off and they'll be able to take sick leave when they need it. And there might even be some there for parents who have used up 5 days of sick leave for children to actually have time off and recover themselves when they're unwell. So what we'll see, I believe, is greater well-being in the workforce. In terms of employers, I think it's the business of all employers to take steps to make sure that their workforce is healthy, or otherwise ultimately it's the business that suffers because workers are sick and people are having to come in and spread illnesses in workplaces where they shouldn't be.
So a little earlier on you mentioned the government would not be increasing the amount of accumulated days. Would you have liked to have seen that as well?
I think that's right. I think that ultimately we should be seeing an accumulation of days. Many workers don't actually take sick leave, and then when they have something severe go wrong, they utilise their accumulated sick leave. So accumulation is a very important part of it. And in a sense, it recognises a lot of people are healthy for most of their lives, and sometimes it's in later life when they are having operations or other interventions that they need that additional time. So from my point of view, I think that increase the accumulation by 3 to 5 days would be a sensible thing to do. I think that there's another element that could be improved upon, and that's that currently the law says that workers don't get their access to their sick leave until they've been employed for 6 months. It's our view that sick leave should kick in from when an employee is employed. Because if you get sick a month after you've been employed, you're still sick. And the risks are still there that the business is impacted and other workers are impacted and the public's impacted by you being at work when you're sick. The hardship that comes from having to take unpaid leave if you don't go into work remains a massive challenge for families. So I think that the thing that should be changed at the same time is that increases from 5 to 10 days is that it should be immediately available. One of the challenges of not making it immediately available, if this comes in halfway through next year, then workers who are just starting jobs halfway through next year are not actually going to be able to access it until the end of next year, which basically means it's a year away before workers are going to be able to access 10 days of sick leave. And I think that that's too long at a time when we're likely to be dealing with the impact of COVID through a better part of next year anyway. So there's no reason why the government couldn't put this into place through urgency before Christmas.
That was Annie Newman from Etu on the government's plan to increase compulsory sick leave entitlements.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. We will be right back after this.
The year is 2020. Across the planet, all hope for humanity is extinguished.
Oh no, my hope for humanity.
But even in the darkest midnight, a little light may shine.
It's a bird. It's a plane.
Shush, I'm trying to listen to Morning Glory.
The 95BFM Summer Sorted Super Prize Pack, coming to a radio near you pretty much right now. Featuring
an Onya e-bike from Bikes and Beyond.
$1,000 to spend at Galbraith's Ale House.
A summer of Lucky Taco delivered to your door.
12 months free internet with Google Nest Wi-Fi, a Yui Boom and a Samsung tablet, thanks to Orcon.
A pair of limited edition Red Bull SL 1210 Mark 7 turntables from Technics.
A starter hydroponic set from Franklin Hydroponics.
A year's subscription to the new Chi flavours from the Chi online store.
A year's worth of coffees from the Mercury Plaza Cafe.
A collection of 2020's best Madman DVD releases and tickets to every Madman cinematic release of 2021.
$250 to spend at Tatties Designer Recycle.
$250 to spend at Marbex Records.
A summer's worth of Arepa brain food.
A $250 hospitality voucher from Ponsonby Social Club. And more.
The Summer Sorted Super Prize Pack. Text SUMMER plus your name and B-card number to 5395. Find out more at 95BFM.com.
Tinnitus can be defined as
a false perception of a sound and the absence of an acoustic stimulus.
It sounds a bit like this. Otago University is conducting a study to better understand early-stage tinnitus. They're asking people who have recently begun to experience tinnitus to complete an online survey to help with their research. If that's you, register now at tinnitus.nz. You'll receive a token of gratitude for your time. That's tinnitus.nz.
Hi, I'm Ken.
Hi, Ken.
It's been 6 months since I've listened to Gin. Not gonna lie, I still miss it. The feeling when the primo tunes are pouring out, the smooth grooves, the weird songs have got flute in them.
Hey, what's that in his ear?
My ear? No, what?
That's a headphone.
No.
This guy's hurting some gin right now.
He's holding out on us. Ears.
If this guy's gonna have some gin, I want some too.
Everyone loves a bit of gin, and no one's gonna blame you if you take an earful every Tuesday, 1 till 4. Gin plays all the good notes that go down easy with a lingering, vibed out aftertaste. The Tuesday 1 to 4 with Gin, thanks to Bikes and Beyond, your e-bike and e-transport specialists. The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. For our next story, Whakaari, White Island erupted on the 9th of December last year and has led to the deaths of 22 people, and many survivors have been left with severe burns. Yesterday, WorkSafe announced that criminal charges have been laid against 13 parties in relation to the Whakaari White Island disaster last year. Whakaari White Island erupted... The 13 parties include 10 organisations and 3 individuals. The nature of the charges have not yet been made clear. However, the 10 organisations charged will face a maximum fine of $1.5 million and the 3 individuals will face fines up to $300,000 each. Some of the organisations involved have confirmed that they are facing charges. These groups are GNS Science, the National Emergency Management Agency, White Island Tours, and Volcanic Air Safaris. The owners of the island, the Buttle family, through Whakaari Management Limited, are also among those charged. WorkSafe Chief Executive Phil Parks says this is the largest and most complex investigation the organisation has ever undertaken. Parks says that WorkSafe has come to the conclusion that the charged parties did not meet their obligations to do all they were required to do to look after the health and safety of the workers and visitors on Whakaari at the time. Parks said the eruption was unexpected but not unforeseeable. This is why the 13 parties are facing criminal charges under the Health and Safety at Work Act. WorkSafe's investigation did not consider the rescue and recovery of the victims of the eruption, so the action does not involve this issue. I spoke with Shane Cronin, who is a professor of volcanology at the University of Auckland, about how the proceedings might impact New Zealand's approach to volcano hazard management in the future. We also talk about how easy it is to prepare for a natural disaster when they can't often be predicted down to the day, and also whether these proceedings will grow public awareness of volcanic activity and the risks around it. Here is Shane. WorkSafe has announced 13 charges around the Whakaari White Island disaster. What impact will the proceedings have on volcanic hazard management?
Well, I hope that they'll have a positive impact in terms of bringing some light on some issues, where there are perhaps gaps in the process that we have in New Zealand at the moment.
What exactly are those gaps, do you think?
The gaps, I think, are mainly in terms of who's responsible for taking action once warnings are issued. And I think that's primarily, you know, where we need to think about, say, for Whakaari, who would be a responsible agency for, say, restricting access if there's warning of unrest, or for any volcanic or geothermal area, for that matter, that would be affected in the same way.
It must be pretty hard to predict what effect a natural disaster could have on people. Obviously, it wasn't predicted that, bang, on that day, that is when the volcano would erupt. So how do you prepare for natural disasters when you can't necessarily tell down to the day or the minute that something's going to happen?
Yeah, you're wrapping up a lot of quite complex stuff in there. They're good questions. So, you know, I think what you're getting to is, the timing is the most difficult thing.
Yeah.
In terms of the effects or the impacts, I think we have pretty good handle on that, at least in terms of, you know, understanding the range of different types and the different sizes of explosions. And, you know, I think that, you know, that is probably something we know best. And in terms of when that happens is the most difficult thing. And, you know, that's a bit of a science step that we need to make. And, you know, we monitor these volcanoes with 24/7 sort of second-by-second monitoring. We may not necessarily be using that as effectively as possible for warning, but, because we've got to make a bit of a knowledge leap from what are some of these things like seismic signals actually telling us in relation to whether an eruption is going to happen or not.
And is it hard, perhaps, to tell what those seismic readings mean unless it happens?
Yeah, I think you learn by experience, and so the more events or more eruptions we have, the better we kind of know the system. But it's more than just waiting. I think we've got to be a little bit more proactive about the way we try to forecast things. There are experimental approaches out there where we, you know, we look at automated methods to look at things like seismic data. And they're a little bit held up, if you like, by, you know, waiting to see whether they actually work. But, you know, essentially, if we think they're going to work, I think we have to start throwing them at the wall and trying a lot of these things out. You know, because if you look at, say, Whakaari is a good example, the last five eruptions, none of them have been predicted per se. Some of them have occurred during level two of the volcanic alert scale and some during level one. But, you know, we haven't had that sort of prediction of, you know, in the next 12 hours something's going to happen. And so if we've got tools that can start doing that, then I think we need to try and start rolling these out, even if we're not really fully sure about everything in terms of those tools yet.
Now, I just wanted your comment on just sort of a last thing that was in your comment with Science Media Centre. You spoke about how the worst possible outcome would be if science agencies such as GNS Science, which is facing charges, would become timid about making public statements for fear of being wrong or being prosecuted. Why is that important, that we avoid treating these groups too harshly?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, what we've seen in Italy For example, around a group of scientists were basically taken to court for failing, for actually issuing a wrong forecast. That put shivers through the spines of most hazard researchers around the world and people that are involved in both warning and providing hazard information to warning agencies. Because, if you are wrong about something, and, we're quite frequently are wrong, that may be on the one side it's a false alarm, okay, and then everybody's upset because, their activity's being restricted because it's a false alarm. But if you're wrong the other way and say, hey, it's safe and there is an eruption, then, people are concerned as to whether they're culpable for that action. I mean, and essentially, if you're doing everything in your best, but power to be able to try and provide a warning and you just didn't know that other critical piece of information, then that's not, that's not something we should be punishing. I mean, it's a process of learning, and hindsight is, it's always easy to go back and say, oh, well, we know this now, and you can't take that knowledge away from you and put yourself back in your shoes back at that time. And so I think we have to be quite bold in giving hazard forecasts and predictions, and we have to be prepared to be wrong. And I think what happens when these decisions or when these announcements or so on are questioned, it does make scientists nervous and make science agencies nervous. Now, I'm not sure what the context of these charges actually are in detail, and it may be that they're not challenging scientific freedom straight away, but they do have the effect of making people a little more nervous about some statements they might want to otherwise make.
We talked a little bit about how this will impact the science community and sort of volcano hazard warning, but do you think it will have an impact on the public and the public's knowledge about volcanic activity, and if you're wanting to go and visit a volcano, like, these are the risks? Do you think that will also heighten people's knowledge about that?
Yes, I think it will bring the issue into the limelight, and we'll uncover some practices. It'll bring maybe a little bit of help and closure for the victims of the Fekadi tragedy, to see that we actually are questioning what we're doing, we are testing the systems we have, and we are looking to improve things for the future. So I think that those are all good things. Even bringing the issue to the fore and bringing the understanding of hazards and risks of some of these activities to the fore is a really good thing. So, if we brush it all under the carpet, we don't learn anything. If we do expose a few sensitive areas, I don't know if this is the format, but it's certainly it's a format to talk about some, difficult hazard issues.
That was Shane Cronin, Professor of Volcanology at University of Auckland, speaking about how the proceedings for the 13 charges in relation to the Fekadi White Island disaster might impact New Zealand's approach to volcano hazard management in the future. Hannah's up next with her piece.
Hello. Māori are underrepresented in local government. While the Māori seats address representation in Parliament, there is no such guarantee of Indigenous representation at the level of local wards and councils. One major barrier stands in the way of establishing Māori wards and constituencies. Under the Local Electoral Act, 5% of local voters can trigger a binding referendum if their council tries to create a Māori ward. This provision does not exist for general wards and constituencies. While iwi, hapu and community groups have overwhelmingly been in favour of establishing such wards, there have been well-funded campaigns against them. 8 out of 9 previous attempts to establish Māori wards have been shut down by this process. There are two petitions concerning this issue, one from Action Station and another from Te Rōpū Tō Toko Māori, a whakatāne-based group advocating for Māori wards in their district council. They have amassed 10,000 signatures asking Parliament to make the process of establishing Māori wards for councils the same as that for establishing general wards. That is, scrapping the referenda provision. Tomorrow, both these petitions will be presented to Labour MP Tamati Koffi, Labour's Kiritapu Allen, Māori Party co-leader Debbie Ngāruapaka, and Green Party co-leader Marama Davidson are also expected to be in attendance. I spoke to Tony Boyden from Te Rōpū Tō Toko Māori about the wards and the questions that their establishment and the referenda provision against them pose for local government, for the policies that emerge from it, and about Te Tiriti obligations. I started by asking her about the organisation's origins and their mahi.
So back in 2017 in Whakatāne, the Whakatāne District Council resolved to support the establishment of Māori seats. And then from there, we called a community to find out about those who were willing to support Māori wards being established, and that decision of the council. And from there, we had a group of people formed who really wanted to go about making sure that people had good information about Māori wards, and also too was to try and deter the petition. Unfortunately, that carried on and we had to go to referendum, and we had a huge effort within the community, support from all across the board to be able to vote yes in that referendum. We just missed out. We were so close, but we weren't able to get it over the line in terms of getting a yes vote, but we did have the closest margin in the country. And so from there, we wanted to look at ensuring that we looked at ways in which we pushed for the change of legislation, which was to remove the ability to petition, because it only affects the establishment of Māori wards. No other wards can be affected by this.
Whakatāne is 43% Māori. Does the makeup of local government reflect this diversity?
So that's part of the difficulty, because when the council decides and makes that decision for Māori to be able to have a voice in council or to be able to have input into the decision making, unfortunately the petition that then allows other people to decide whether or not that Māori voice should be heard. So depending on the population, the majority of the time Māori population is a lot lower in the general population, it's very hard for us to win a referendum.
Across the country where these referenda have been initiated, there's been quite fervent opposition against establishing these wards. What groups are behind this opposition, generally?
So from what we know, in 2018, we understood that Hobson's Pledge had a very large campaign, up to $250,000 campaign against the establishment of Māori wards. They had a lot of resources and obviously time to be able to put in that. And it's quite sad. There's a sort of, you know, group that I suppose has a very limited view in terms of what the treaty partnership is and how that relationship is meant to work. They sort of turn it into kind of race-based seating when really, it really is about treaty partnerships, treaty-based seats. So for a long time, Māori haven't had that same equity in the decision-making process, although that was part of the treaty agreement. The treaty itself allowed settlers here to settle. There's part of the relationship that hasn't quite happened for the other party. And so part of being able to have the voice in local government is to be able to assure that that same due respect is met.
So as you mentioned, iwi, hapu and community groups, that is those who are affected by this decision, were in favour of establishing Māori wards. What danger is there in having minority rights be subject to majority rule?
Well, the danger is, and what we've seen, is that there's a lack of that representation in communities. And the representation part is really about having that voice of the land, a voice of the people who have actually lived in those districts for over 1,000 years. So who better to know the land, the water, and what happens with the land than the people who've been there the longest and who originate from there? And that's a really important voice that's missing at our decision-making table, particularly now when we see the effects of climate change, when we see the changes in legislation and regulations in terms of sustainability requirements for councils, when we see the upgrades that councils have to make in terms of our wastewater systems and drinking water systems, there's a voice there that has a knowledge base that's been around for a long time to actually help and assist in a lot of the problems that are there today, to do with our environment, to do with better relationships within the community, so that solutions from the community and from the ground can actually speak at those council tables.
So it's not just about representation, although that's very important, it's that better representation also leads to better policy.
Definitely, and better policy means better decision-making. It also means better democracy for everybody. You know, there's nothing to lose from having Māori sitting at the table, because Māori have a vested interest in ensuring that everyone is looked after, that the land is looked after, that our water and resources are looked after for our children and for our grandchildren, because ultimately that is part of the Māori worldview, is to ensure that we look after everyone and that we look after those who are still yet to come, and that there is a resource that can keep us healthy, that can keep us continuing on. So if we have a healthy environment, we have healthy people and we have healthy lives.
That this law that allows referendums to be triggered only applies to Māori wards just kind of seems prima facie discriminatory. Does the government have obligations under Te Tiriti to amend this?
Yes, so one of the obligations is under Article 3, which is part of being able to participate in the governance of your people and lands, and also in decision making. It also affects United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People in Article 4, which also emphasises the same thing, that Indigenous people will be able to have an input into the decision-making and participate in the decision-making process when it comes to the governing of their lands and people. So there is, and has been around for a long time, those long-standing things that highlight the discrimination that is happening with this particular law. Now, out of the 9 referendums that have been held since this law came in 2001, there's only been 1 district council, which is Wairoa District Council, who has been successful in winning a referendum, and that's mainly because they have a high population of Māori. I don't know whether when that legislation was established, that part was meant to be in there, but it's a hook that sort of stopped that voice from being heard, and we need it removed. For a long time, Māori has not been represented. Over 180 years, we haven't been represented in a Māori worldview at the table of those decisions.
Democracy kind of justifies itself as being a participatory system, but engagement with local government politics is generally quite low. Would the establishment of Māori wards increase engagement and therefore strengthen democracy?
I mean, I believe that it would. It is a start. I don't believe it's the end or be all, because there are multiple levels in which changes need to be made so that the voice is heard at different parts. We need to ensure that we don't get into situations where Māori wards or having Māori seats is either or kind of situation of you have this, so therefore you can't have these different things, which might be iwi partnership models which allow for representation in particular committees to give advice in those committees, but also to have Māori wards alongside that to ensure that at the decision-making table there is representatives there to represent the Māori worldview and perspective. You know, we've got a part of our community who has disengaged for a long time because there is a mistrust in terms of the processes and things that have happened with local council, and there is a disengagement there when it comes to voter turnout because so many things have happened in the past, and so there is a disengagement. Having Māori in council and sitting at the table with that perspective then allows our younger generation and our rangatahi to be able to see themselves reflected in the leaders of the community in the decision-making process, and then hopefully see that when decisions are made, how they view the world is also reflected and valued in those decisions. And that goes a huge way, not only in terms of Māori then being able to regain trust in a key part of their community, but also too for young people of future generations to be able to know that they are valued in their community and that they are seen in positions of value in the community.
Did you have anything that you wanted to add?
What I really want to add is that we have 9 districts at the moment who are going through the Māori Wards process. And, you know, a big congratulations to all those district councils who have taken the brave step to say yes to Māori Wards. If that is your district, get in behind and help those who are leading the campaign there to support them, whether you can volunteer there at your time, whether you can support them on social media, whether you can support them with donations towards their campaign. We really need to support those who are coming from a very grassroots level to be able to ensure that if they do go to referendum, that people are informed, their community is well informed, and that the community votes yes for Māori Wards.
That was Tony Boyden from Te Rōpū Tō Toko Māori speaking about the need for Māori Wards and the barriers to establishing them.
You're tuned into The Wire with Jemima, Hannah and Noah. We will be right back with one final piece after this.
Whether you're cramming for that last exam or snowed under by the end of year crunch, sometimes we all need a little boost to our mental clarity. Arepa is New Zealand's number one brain drink. Caffeine-free and made from powerful, all-natural ingredients, Arepa is proven by neuroscience to keep you calm and thinking clear when you need it most. Arepa. Found in all good supermarkets or buy online at drinkarepa.com.
Nothing says summer like the smell of sunscreen, a picnic on the beach, crisp salad, succulent dip, and the best organic sourdough either side of the Bombays. Bread and Butter make real sourdough, supporting organic practices with New Zealand-grown grains and the best locally supplied ingredients. Bread and Butter, for bread that's better. 3 stores across Auckland, Grayland, Milford and Ponsonby. And coming soon to the Coast Plaza in Whangaparoa. Order online at breadandbutter.nz.
Ding dang, ding dang dong. The bells are ringing out for the 95 BFM Whammy Bar and Wine Cellar Christmas Party with
Babyface Killer, Dead Famous People, Echo O's, Guardian Singles, Louisa Nicklin, Po Diso, Phoebe Rings, Ruby Doo, Sulfate and Surly.
Simply having a wonderful Christmas party. Saturday, December 19th at Whammy Bar and Wine Cellar. $10 on the door or $5 with a can for the Auckland City Mission.
Thanks to Scrumpy, an NZ classic since 1991.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
You're listening to The Wire. Now it's time for our final piece. This year's election had its highest turnout since 1999, and due to COVID and the increase of early voting, there was a particular focus on the voting process. The Electoral Commission has just released data on official turnout, revealing a big increase in the youth and Māori vote. The youth vote increased by almost 20%, and the Māori vote increased by just over 15%. I spoke to Chief Electoral Officer Alicia Wright about the Commission's findings. Can you start by explaining the new data that has been released around voting?
So now that the election is over, we're able to do that analysis around the number of people who voted, broken down by age and by Māori descent. And so we can identify what groups of people in terms of their age voted and those of Māori descent and how those differ.
And so what did you find? What were the changes?
So what we found was that our young people really came out in big numbers this election. We saw big increases in our 18 to 24 and our 25 to 29-year-olds. And that was a big jump up from 2017 and from 2014 as well.
What were some of the things the Electoral Commission did differently this time round in terms of promoting voting?
So a big thing that we really focused on was having really targeted advertising campaigns for our younger voters. We had social influencers. We had campaigns going out. We had youth advocates and community liaisons out in the community, and we really focused on putting voting places wherever we could so that we made it as easy as possible for people to enroll and vote.
And so you just touched upon the social media campaigns, and I saw a bit about that online. Could you go into that?
So one of the things that we focus on is getting messages around where and how and why it's important to vote. And so we identified, and so we can reach out, but we know that we can only reach out so far. And so what we really focused on was identifying those people who work in that social media space who have a wide reach with a whole variety of different communities. So we wanted to ensure that we had young people who focused on Pacifica, Maori communities, all different sorts of communities to ensure that they were talking about why it was important for them to vote.
And so with all of these changes, did you expect to see such an increase in the vote?
You never can tell what's going to happen with turnout. So one of the big things that we had this year, of course, is this was not a typical sort of a year in any way, shape, or form. Obviously, we had COVID-19 that we were working through. We had a date change around the election, and there's a whole variety of different factors that can impact turnout, even on a normal election year. Our focus is always to do everything that we can to make it as easy as possible for people to enroll and vote, to get the word out. And then how it's going to turn out really is over to the voters. And, of course, this was an interesting election this year as well, because not only was the general election, but we had the two referendums as well.
And so you mentioned we've had an unusual year. And in the lead-up to the election, there was a lot of coverage on the significance of early voting. Do you think early voting had an impact on the youth vote or the Maori vote?
I think it has. I think early voting and really pushing for people to vote when it's most convenient for them, when it's close to home, and seeing voting places pop up all over the place and being able to go into them quite easily, makes it a much more straightforward exercise, and I think people really embraced it. So this election, we saw 69% of people voted early, and so that's a big jump up from 2017.
And so, I know we've just finished one election, but thinking to the future, is the focus on early voting, reaching out to different communities, is that going to remain a focus in future elections? And
We will absolutely be doing both of those things in 2023. One of the things that we have been doing is working more closely with the communities across the board, having those youth advocates, community liaisons, having people embedded in the community, and doing that on a more regular basis throughout the year. So we're not just popping up every 3 years, that we're working in the communities and for the community. So that will be a continuing focus that we have. One of the other things that we'll be focusing on as well is we'll continue to encourage people to vote whenever and however they can in the most easy way possible. And what we're hoping we'll be able to do in 2023 that we weren't able to do this time is have a lot more voting places in places like supermarkets and places where people pop in and out of during the week as well. We weren't able to do that this time because of COVID, because there wasn't enough space. So we really see that expanding out in 2023.
One final question. Do you expect the youth vote to continue increasing?
We would really love to see that happen, and we'll do everything that we can to encourage that. Once people vote, they're lifelong voters, and we really want to see that happen.
That was the Electoral Commission's Chief Electoral Officer, Alicia Wright, on New Zealand's increased youth and Māori vote.
That was The Wire.
That was the Tuesday Wire for another week. I did have one final piece that we were sort of hoping to play about food waste, but we will play it next week so you won't miss out on that content about saving money and not wasting food. But anyway, thank you very much to everyone who spoke with us for the show today. Thank you very much, Noah and Hannah, for being awesome producers. How do you feel it went today?
It's good. Little blip at the start.
Yeah, a little blip at
the
start.
We overcame it.
Good to be back on The Wire.
Yeah, so good to have Hannah back as well. It's nice to have a nice full studio with all of us. Yeah, hope you have a very good day out there in the lead up to, you know, the holidays. It's kind of come around pretty quickly. So all look after yourself out there. Keep washing your hands. COVID-19's still a thing. Up next is Jen with the 1-4. We will catch you next time.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.